Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for tuning into the ongoing series of the Sydney Institute's virtual talks and discussions at a time of pandemic. And we're very grateful today to have two distinguished Australians to talk about the topic of Australia and China, two views, and thanks to our associate members who've sent in some questions for the question discussion period. Both of our speakers will speak for about 15 minutes, and then we'll have a question discussion period. Now, they're both well known. I'll introduce them briefly. Tim Harcourt is J.W. Neville, Fellow in Economics at the University of New South Wales. He's the author of The Airport Economist, which has had many editions, and host of The Airport Economist on Sky News, and a former chief economist at Austrade, and Tony Abbott. Probably his best known book is Battle Lines, but most importantly, Australia's 28th Prime Minister. So we'll start off with Mr. Abbott, go to Mr. Harcourt, and on we go. Thank you, Tony.
Well, it was scarcely 5 years ago. Australia and China had just finalised a free trade deal. Australia had just been admitted into China's club of comprehensive strategic partners. And in our own national parliament, President Xi Jinping himself made the pretty extraordinary declaration that China would be, and I quote, democratic by the middle of the century. Now, even though he might not have meant democracy in our sense, it still seemed a watershed moment, perhaps the high tide of the optimism about China that most Westerners had cherished since the market reforms of Deng Xiaoping, thinking that more economic freedom would inevitably mean some political freedom and that sooner or later China would resemble Hong Kong, only on a colossal scale. But as we now know only too well, China's communist leaders did not see market freedoms as a prelude to political ones. For them, allowing people to trade was a concession to make China richer, not to make its citizens freer. After all, the same leader who'd said that to get rich is glorious had also advised his comrades to hide their strength and to bide their time. And now, that time has finally come to banish China's century of humiliation and once more to become the world's middle kingdom or dominating power. So clearly it was a mistake to think that Marxism-Leninism shouldn't be taken too seriously, or that it wouldn't reinforce traditional Chinese exceptionalism. And with the Communist Party unchallenged, and with Xi utterly dominant, the prospect of any convergence between China and the West anytime soon is almost non-existent. A million plus Uyghurs will continue to languish in concentration camps. The rule of law in Hong Kong will slowly be strangled. The capacity to retake Taiwan will constantly be strengthened. Chinese people at home and abroad will endure ever more pervasive surveillance and attempts at control. And countries that object or protest will increasingly be subject to cyber attacks and trade repercussions. The new normal is a cold peace at best, and we'd better get used to it. Now, one of the reasons we struggled to get China is that it's the one country that Australians routinely deal with that's quite unlike us. Its businesses are not private. Its citizens are not free and cannot say what they really think. China does everything with strategic intent. All that really matters is whether it strengthens the Chinese state. But for us, loyalty to the country does not mean being subordinated to the state or to the party. citizens and businesses are expected to pursue their own interests. What's more, without centuries of oppressive government or a history of invasion, our inclination is to take people at face value, to assume goodwill, and to give others the benefit of the doubt. Now, of course, as Hong Kong, Taiwan, and Singapore prove, let alone all those Australians of Chinese descent, there is no authoritarian gene in Chinese DNA. None. Like nearly everyone, Chinese people want freedom and justice as much as wealth. It's just that they have no expectation of getting it from their own government. So how does a country like Australia cope when its biggest trading partner has become its biggest strategic challenge? To start, by not indulging in wishful thinking and self-blame, or by adopting a false moral equivalence between China and the United States, characterised by a massive double standard in judging their leaders. If China does divert its iron ore and coal imports from Australia to Brazil and to Indonesia instead, that will hurt. Profits will fall, tax revenue will fall, and jobs will be hit. If China turns off the tap of foreign students, that will hurt too. But China buys our products because that's good for China, not because it's good for us. And China sends its students here because of what it can get, not because of what it can give. China is more than ready, much readier than we are, to take some pain in order to teach us a lesson, to warn its students off, and to subject our exports to bogus safety inspection and capricious hold-ups. But rather than complain about the alleged inadequacies of our own government, we just have to accept that this is the price of dealing with a thin-skinned dictatorship. For us, the real economic pain will come after the development of additional, alternative, Chinese-controlled iron ore, gas and coal supplies in third world countries that are more susceptible to exploitation. And this is where our own scrupulosity on ethical and environmental standards is likely to end up doing much more harm than good. With projects like the Simandou iron ore province in Guinea and the cobalt monopoly of the Congo are falling into Chinese hands while our own domestic cost structures keep going up. Even so, our challenge is not to sell less to China, because while China needs our goods and services, they're at least somewhat dependent on us. Our challenge is to buy less from China, because having China in our supply chains is what makes us economically dependent on them. Now, I am not suggesting abrogating the free trade deal, given that in practice it's been better for our exports than for China's. Tariffs are a blunt instrument. But there'd be no reason why government, in all its own purchases, shouldn't have a premium for Australian made, and for anything sensitive, a requirement that all the components are sourced from trusted countries. This would be a larger scale version, if you like, of the decision to ban Huawei from participation in the NBN or the 5G network. Because China has been so good at exploiting rules that it doesn't adhere to itself on emissions reduction, for instance, or on intellectual property law, Australia's approach going forward should be one of strict reciprocity, on accepting foreign investment, on allowing students into courses with strategic spin-off, and on permitting land ownership. We should only allow China or its citizens to do here what they would allow us to do there. Effectively, that means no further Chinese land ownership in Australia. It means Chinese investment only in joint ventures in the old economy. It means being very selective about academic collaborations. And it means hardly any Chinese higher degree students in maths and the hard sciences. Given that the communist government has never allowed anarchic and encrypted Western social media into China, lest its own people be able to fly under the radar as ours can, why shouldn't we take Donald Trump's lead and ban Chinese government-owned intelligence-gathering devices like WeChat? Now, we can't and we shouldn't disengage with China, but our dealings with them have to be as hard-headed and as strategically minded as theirs are with us. We should be more conscious of what we have done for China and less intimidated by what they have done for themselves or might do for us. By giving China a measure of resource, energy and food security, Australia has indeed helped in shifting 500 million Chinese from the third world to the middle class in scarcely a generation. All credit to the Chinese people and to the government since Deng's time for at least not standing in the way of the biggest and fastest advance in human well-being in all history. But can China's rise remain peaceful? That's the great question right now for the whole world. In my judgment, the best way to prevent tension escalating into armed conflict is to ensure that no potential adversary can ever think that a war could easily be won. Although American and Chinese forces were able to fight a serious war in Korea that stayed contained, we can't rely on being so lucky again. Even so, making excuses for aggression, especially towards Taiwan, the most likely flashpoint, or questioning whether the United States should or would honour its security commitments in East Asia, is more likely to embolden the Chinese than encourage them to accept a rules-based international order. When China's foreign minister told his Singaporean counterpart at a conference in 2010 that, and I quote, "China is a big country and other countries are small countries, that's just a fact," it was the old Athenian ultimatum to Melos: the strong do what they will and the weak suffer what they must, only with Chinese characteristics. To me, Australia's best role here is to be a strong contributing member of a Western alliance that responds to the abrogation of the One Country, Two Systems Treaty over Hong Kong with targeted sanctions against China's leaders, a little like those imposed on Russia for the seizure of the Crimea, and that routinely practices freedom of navigation exercises past the illegal artificial islands in the South China Sea. To the Chinese government, the only difference between Hong Kong and Taiwan is that Taiwan, now a thriving liberal pluralist democracy of 25 million people, has capable armed forces and is still defensible with American support, despite China's massive build-up. But to a regime that regards any dissent as radioactive within its claimed borders, fostering any real doubt about American support for Taiwan could be creating an opportunity that's too tempting to ignore. You see, sometimes not making a stand has worse consequences than doing so. In the absence of official provocation, such as a unilateral declaration of independence, any American failure to help defend Taiwan in the face of a Chinese assault would spell the collapse of the American alliance system right around the world. It would mean that America could not be relied upon in a tight corner. For the countries of our region, that would mean accepting vassal status or arming to the teeth to become all but impregnable. Now, I agree with Paul Dibb that if Australia failed to provide military support to a US defence of Taiwan, it would be the end of the ANZUS alliance, other than as window dressing. It would be the first time in our history that we had put the appeasement of a dictatorship ahead of the defence of democracy. And it would be hard to escape the damning judgment that there was nothing much that we would take risks for. No friend or no ideal short of our own survival, by which time we would inevitably be on our own. To John Howard's sunny optimism that Australians would not have to choose between our history and our geography, I always used to add this rider, that we shouldn't try to make new friends by abandoning old ones. And the best way to ensure that the unthinkable remains unlikely is to keep reminding the Chinese government that any move on Taiwan could have the direst consequences. I fear that our Prime Minister is indeed right to see echoes of the 1930s in these times. Even so, all those Chinese Australians who have chosen freedom and the rule of law over conformism and state power boost my confidence that our way of life can long be maintained.
Well, Australia and China have known each other for quite a while now. The Chinese people have engaged with Australia from almost the beginnings of British settlement of the continent that became our nation. In the mid-19th century, the Chinese migrants came to the goldfields and developed a retail industry. In fact, many of those same migrants went back to China and established the first retail department stores in Shanghai and Canton, now Guangzhou. At the end of the 19th century, the colonial governments engaged with China and sent trade missions. And after Federation, we set up our first Australian trade office in Asia in Shanghai in the 1920s, despite much Foreign Office opposition in London. The Great Depression and war intervened, and of course the Chinese Revolution in 1949. Records suggest that the Chifley government almost recognised China in 1949. The UK did so in the 1950s. But it took until 1971 for Australia to engage with China officially as the People's Republic. After the revolution, China was isolated from the world, and it took a bold move by an opposition leader, Gough Whitlam, in 1971 to go to Peking as it then was, and as it happened, in step with Henry Kissinger and President Richard Nixon. When I interviewed his long-time political opponent, Doug Anthony, he described Gough Whitlam's China move as his finest hour. And I'll quote Doug Anthony. Gough surprised us all on China. Gough always wanted to take a risk and make a big statement on everything, including foreign policy. And he deserved credit for doing so in the case of China. Since then, Australia's relations with China have mainly been bipartisan, but it's brought us tensions as well as trade. We've seen the ups and downs with China and Australia and all our prime ministers since Gough Whitlam. We saw tears from Bob Hawke over Tiananmen, which actually helped relations. We saw Paul Keating stick up for China's WTO membership against the wishes of the Clinton administration. We saw some tense early days between John Howard and Jiang Zemin that recovered and ended up with an LNG deal. We saw Kevin Rudd expand our diplomatic vocabulary over climate change. And of course, we saw Tony Abbott sign a free trade agreement. Now, in the 21st century, we have more tensions, some trade-related in terms of beef and barley more recently. Now, these problems were brewing before the coronavirus or COVID-19, but they've intensified given the way the Chinese government handled the spread of the mystery virus from Wuhan to the rest of China and to the rest of the world, and its response since. As the Lowy Institute's Richard McGregor has pointed out, China's mishandling of the coronavirus, its suppression and shutdown of its economy, and its diplomatic stance since has exposed both the weakness and the strength of the Chinese political system. Now, the current trade tensions with China has prompted a polarised debate in Australia. In the so-called blue corner, the defence and security community has argued that trade-wise, we must diversify away from China at any cost. They mainly see the world in terms of defence and security alliances, and they're concerned, rightly so, at the influence of China on Australian institutions. In the so-called red corner, there is a pro-China business lobby. They are less interested in spooky matters of defence and cybersecurity, and they think we should pretty much do whatever China wants, as they are our biggest customer. This has led to some prominent Australian business people getting quite vocal and activist on the relationship. One told our diplomats to show more respect towards China, and another even invited a Chinese diplomat to speak at the press conference of an Australian cabinet minister, much to the minister's surprise. For them, it's always, as my grandfather used to say, business is business. So how is this debate practical or helpful as we think about the future of China and Australian economic relations? Well, in assessing the merits of the so-called reds and blues, there's a few points to consider. First, can we diversify? Well, the answer is we always diversify in terms of trade. That's why governments negotiate bilateral trade agreements and the like. That's why China diversifies its import sources, like with Brazil and Australia in terms of iron ore. Just like businesses diversify, customers and investors do the same. After all, the famous Yale economist James Tobin won the Nobel Prize in Economics for his optimal portfolio allocation theorem, which is basically winning the Nobel Prize for saying, don't put all your eggs in the one basket. Secondly, should we diversify? Well, there are good stories to tell. If we look at our long-standing partners in Northeast Asia, in terms of food and energy security, South Korea and Japan have always been important and will continue to be so. In Southeast Asia, if we bring together all those very distinct countries together, that's a huge market for Australian exporters. India is up and coming, not to mention the emerging markets of Europe, the Middle East, Africa, the Americas, and of course the Pacific. And whilst it's a good idea to build up other markets, there's no need for substitution. There's no need to underestimate our China economic relationship, particularly when it accounted for 46% of our goods exports this year to June, despite all the headlines and the COVID-19 related interruptions. And of course, there's the middle class purchasing power of China to come that we've already seen. Even in Foreign Affairs' own white paper, the base case that they consider has China increasing its purchasing power in 2030 by an amount more than the increase in the US, Japan, India and Indonesia combined. Indeed, as they say, size does matter. The China trade itself is worth $235 billion compared to $88 billion with Japan. And even if you look at the numbers of small business exporters, there's almost 8,000 small businesses selling goods to China, with 6,500 to Hong Kong. This overshadows the numbers selling goods to Indonesia, the United Arab Emirates, at about 2,500 each, and well ahead of India on just around 2,000. Then there's the Australian businesses actually based in China. There's around 3,000 compared to, say, 100 in the Japanese market. And that's even before we look at those numbers of students and tourists and the exports of other professional services. Thirdly, as a democracy, can the federal government really tell a business to diversify and that's that? Well, in the Airport Economist TV series on second-tier cities, I interviewed a South Australian wine exporter, Pip Crawford, who developed Shearer's Hill, a special red wine just for the city of Qingdao in Shandong, the sister province of South Australia. Now, Pip's put a lot of time and investment into that regional market, foregoing the bigger cities of Shanghai and Beijing, and she's been very successful. It's very hard for the federal government to tell her to suddenly walk away from that lucrative contract to go somewhere else. She wouldn't want to be keen to switch cities, let alone countries. But it is true that trade is not all about the free market. There's a lot of government fiat involved, that is, direct regulatory decisions that affect trade. And the government itself is involved in trade. When you think of defence, education, research and development and healthcare, a lot of trade is government to government. Fourthly, the economic relationship is not just about trade. There's also investment, and a lot of investment is actually by governments via state-owned enterprises. They're actually state government decisions, not necessarily business decisions. But even so, we look at foreign direct investment. China is still not a big player when you compare it to the USA, the UK, Europe, the Benelux countries, the Netherlands, Belgium and Luxembourg, of course, Japan and Singapore. Finally, in Australia, we think it's all about us. Well, Australia is not alone. There are tensions between China and other nations too. If you look at the diverse list, there's tensions with India, South Korea, France, the UK, the Czech Republic, Belgium, Japan, the United States, and more recently now Ecuador, just to name a few. China's regime is under incredible pressure due to the nature of how it let the virus spread internationally from Wuhan, and the nature of its dealings with the World Health Organization. This has put economic pressure on Xi Jinping and the governing class in China hence some of the overreaction diplomatically and the fraught nature of its handling of the One Nation, Two Systems principle in Hong Kong. In conclusion, Australia has had relations with the Chinese people for a long time, as I mentioned, for the 19th century. But the Chinese state in its current form only since Gough Whitlam's famous visit to Peking in 1971. But whilst Gough Whitlam is sometimes thought to be heralded by some and criticised by some for being too idealistic, when it comes to China, he was actually a realist. Stephen Fitzgerald, Australia's first ambassador to the People's Republic, pointed out that Gough Whitlam was neither a Sinophile nor a Sinophobe, and he reflected of his old boss. For him, for Australia to have relations with China was rational and logical and self-interested. And we must accept China as a permanent and significant part of the international political landscape, whatever its colour, a view similar to that taken two decades earlier by Winston Churchill. Now, the nature of this bilateral relationship has taken many twists and turns, especially as China has become an important player in the world trading system. This will continue given China's importance to Australia. And for sure, Australia needs China economically. But given China's enormous need for energy security, for food security, for infrastructure and professional services, and for an excellent quality education for its young generation, China needs Australia too. And in these times of COVID-19, with closed borders and changing alliances, we are not going to see an outright rejection of globalisation, but a reset. And that includes a reset of our economic relations with China, something that all nations will be contemplating now, not just Australia. Thank you.
So thanks for two important addresses. Let's say we start with you, Tony. What do you see the main problem with Australia's relationship with China? I think in your speech there you seem to be talking about the possibility of China stealing some of our potential mineral markets. Is that the most substantial problem on the economic field, apart from foreign policy? What others are there?
Well, I think that's certainly something we have to be prepared for. I'm not against us selling massively to China. I'm in favour of us selling massively to China. I think as time goes by and the strategic competition between the United States and China intensifies, China will be more and more reluctant to buy from Western allies like Australia if there are alternatives. And that's exactly what they're trying to do. They're trying to develop alternative supplies of the coal and iron ore that we currently sell massively to China. In places like Guinea, they're obviously eyeing off cornering the world cobalt market in the Congo. And I am sure they would be much happier to buy more coal from Indonesia than more coal from us. So while I think we should sell as much as we can to the Chinese, I think we have to be careful about buying as much from the Chinese as we currently do, particularly when it comes to things that are of critical importance to our own national security, such as drugs, PPE and IT componentry. But I also think we have to be aware that the Chinese are most likely going to prefer, as soon as they can, to buy elsewhere as well.
But presumably that would be some years away.
I don't think they could diversify away from us to supply vast amounts of iron ore and coal anytime soon. But within 5 or 10 years, I certainly think they could make significant changes. And that obviously has massive implications for some of our biggest businesses like BHP and Rio.
Tim, the greatest problem on the economic sphere, what do you see that as?
Well, I think the biggest economic problem would be something going terribly wrong with China. And as I said in my remarks, the Chinese political system, we may think it's all omnipresent, but it's got some problems. And the governing class in China is under pressure over how they handled the virus from Wuhan and how they shut down the economy and how they let it out and what they did to the doctor in Wuhan and so on. So I think the Chinese, the biggest threat is the Chinese having internal issues that causes them problems. In In regard to Tony's address, I thought one important thing I got from Tony's address was, it's right, China needs Australia. I mean, China buys iron ore, coal, LNG, education, agriculture, because it's good for China. It's good for this massive, you know, rise from rural poverty into the middle class. So they don't do it to do us a favour. And ultimately, at the end of the day, business is business. We are a very reliable supply of all these things. And so there will be rhetoric, there will be tension, as there's been from every Prime Minister, from Whitlam to Abbott to Morrison and everyone in between. But ultimately, those same trends will be important for China, because they've still got 1.3 billion mouths to feed at the end of the day.
But the view you're both expressing there is not all that commonly heard among sections of the academic class in Australia, who seem to regard us as very dependent on China, and among sections of business, who don't tend to put the view that China needs us as much as we need them. So how do you change that debate in the country?
We have a terrible tendency, Jared, to underestimate ourselves. Sure, we're not the world's biggest country or the world's strongest country, but we're not insignificant by any means. We have to appreciate that we can do a lot for the wider world. We do a lot for the wider world. So instead of constantly thinking of ourselves as a small and insignificant country, we should think more of ourselves as a quite powerful and influential country with the potential to do more and to be more. And while obviously we're never going to be as populous or as economically strong as China, we certainly are no mean country, even to them.
I've got to say, Jared, this has always puzzled me. I mean, in the Airport Economist series, I think I went to 60 countries in 5 years. And in every country I saw, winemakers in Shandong province doing amazing things, South Australian McLaren Vale, technology guys in Argentina, Western Australians in Russia, doing incredible things. I come back to Australia and everyone says, oh, Australia, we're so lazy. Our productivity's terrible. We're missing the boat on this. You know, the classic was at the Sydney Olympics 2000. Yeah. Carly Farini came out here and said, you know, it's the new economy. If Australia doesn't close down all its rocks and crops and its old economy and start selling software like Taiwan, the Australian dollar will be 30 cents, you know, 10 years' time. And we saw the biggest boom in our terms of trade in our economic history. So I think, you know, from what I see in terms of economic performance and the great efforts of Australian entrepreneurs overseas and at home, it just sends an incredible disconnect with the, you know, the public view that Australia's hopeless at everything and we're weak and we're this little power, you know, and the best they'll say is we're this little country and punched above our weight. We're not a little country, we're a medium-sized economic power with a lot of success.
Exactly right. I mean, you know, we are much better than we think we are, and often enough we're our own worst enemies.
As you mentioned, Tony, one of the lessons out of COVID-19 will probably be the West Australia, United States dependence on pharmaceuticals and other medical equipment coming out of China. Now, that didn't happen suddenly. It probably happened over, our dependence probably happened over 10 to 20 years. But how do you turn that around without substantial protection for increasing the local production of drugs?
Well, interestingly, the PBS, the Australian PBS, is effectively one of the world's largest drug purchasers.
Now, PBS?
The Pharmaceutical Benefits Scheme. Yeah. Which is one of the reasons why the American drug companies have always been so keen to get us to change the rules to reduce our purchasing power. If, as a government, we decided that the PBS was going to preference locally made or trusted friend made drugs and other medical supplies, we could certainly make a big difference. At different times, we have had quite a substantial drug manufacturing industry in Australia. I think it's diminished somewhat in recent times, basically because so many businesses have taken globalisation to an extreme and have just gone for the cheapest. Well, as anyone who is in personal contact business knows, cheapest is not necessarily best, because it's not just the price, it's the reliability, it's the relationship that you've got with your supplier, which is critical. And what we've seen with the corona crisis is that we can have these things turned on and off like a tap, and we can't afford to have something as vital to our well-being as life-saving drugs as precarious as that.
We know the controversy about governments putting money, or the demand that governments put more and more money into renewables. Mm-hmm. Would you suggest that governments should put money into pharmaceuticals?
I'm saying that we should use our purchasing power to do more to encourage an Australian industry, and an industry which is as reliant as it is on one sometimes capricious supplier.
Is that too protectionist?
Well, it's interesting, Gerard. I mean, when you think about, you know, coronanomics, the economics of the corona crisis, we actually have seen more flexibility and capacity manufacturing than we thought we had. And there's this thing that Tony says about us underestimating us. You saw Gecko's mineral processing in Ballarat, sells to 60 countries, switch to ventilators. You saw Detmolds in Adelaide. Even in Botany, you know, one drop brewery goes from craft beer to making hand sanitizer. So our manufacturing capability is actually a lot better and a lot more nimble than we think. And when you think of pharmaceuticals, medical, health, we've got, obviously, you know, we've got the Cochlears, we've got ResMed, we've got Blackmores, we've got the Garvan Institute in Melbourne. And we've actually got a lot of capability in that area that has got ability without protectionism. We've actually done it pretty well, perhaps haven't celebrated it as much as we should.
But I think it is also, I grant you all those points, Tim, and they're very important points, but I think it's also true that a lot of things that those companies, those great Australian companies did onshore, are now happening offshore, and as an act of national policy, without bringing in tariff walls, I think we can offer all sorts of encouragements to see more of that produced domestically.
I don't know when to insult you, but some might call that Trumpism, bringing Australian companies back.
Well, look,
But it seemed to work in the US a bit.
I think that's a very fair point. And look, while Trump's style, to put it mildly, is very abrasive, prior to the coronavirus, I think even the most jaundiced observer would have to accept that the bloke was doing a fair job. And one of his strengths is that he has brought a clear-eyed view of China to the American polity that wasn't there before. I think he has permanently shifted the way the American polity looks at China, and I think that was a necessary and overdue corrective.
But just on this point, I mean, some of our Australian champions, you know, Cochlear have got some base in Europe to get that market, yeah. But also in Australia.
Yeah.
You know, and in the same way in the Thai, you know, eastern seaboard of Thailand, where you've got the automotive.
Yeah.
Obviously, some people have got a base there to be close to the manufacturers,
yeah.
And they're creating jobs in Moorabbin,
yeah.
in Secura. So you can do both. But having said that, and this is where I agree with Tony, is that we talk about belonging to global supply chains. Yeah. They're not China supply chains. They're not meant to be one market.
No.
So you don't put all your eggs in the basket of one market, just in the same way as you don't have everything at home.
Yeah.
But you diversify your global supply chains. And I think what perhaps this is the point when we talk about relative trade patterns is that, you know, Japan runs a lot of the Asia-Pacific supply chains in which Vietnam and Thailand and so on,
yeah.
make contributions. And that's...
But again, Tim, see, that the one of the points I was trying to make is that China is different to almost every other country, even Vietnam, although Vietnam remains a communist autocracy at home, in that China has, I think the word is hegemonic, I can never pronounce it properly, it aims to be a hegemon, as it were, in a way that almost no other country does.
Which is not free market.
Not surprisingly, China is very similar to the old Soviet Union in terms of its geostrategic approach, and yet we never let the old Soviet Union into our supply chains. The Soviet Union didn't actually want to be in our supply chains. The Chinese, in their shrewdness, did decide at some point post-Mao that they wanted to be in our supply chains. We, from an abundance of goodwill, were happy to have them. And now we have a situation where China is a much more intimidating competitor than the old Soviet Union ever was. Russia was a first-rate military sustained by a third-rate economy. China is a first-rate economy, becoming stronger all the time, or at least until recently becoming stronger all the time, and rapidly becoming a first-rate military too. And this is why I think we have to accept that China is not just another country. It's not India. It's not Indonesia. It's not even Vietnam. It's quite different.
Imagine how great it would be if it was democratic.
Exactly
right.
Imagine
it was like Singapore or Taiwan.
Exactly.
Or South Korea.
And you see, the long-term hope, which has been utterly misplaced so far, is that over time we will see that kind of evolution in China. Because as I keep stressing, there is no authoritarian gene in Chinese DNA. It's just that we see Chinese people leave the Middle Kingdom and they're entrepreneurial. They're sort of liberal pluralists the way most people are if they're given a chance. But historically, and particularly since 1949, there has been this thoroughgoing totalitarianism in China itself.
The Soviet Union, as you know, broke down partly because the economy broke, but also the nationalities broke away from the Russians. China doesn't really have a nationality problem. The Soviet Union had
But look at what they're doing to the Uyghurs.
They've got a minor problem.
Yeah, they've got a much less significant problem, and they're treating it with utter ruthlessness. I mean, if the reports coming out of Western China are correct, it does look like something approaching genocide going on there.
But otherwise, the regime is fairly stable, you would think, would you?
Well, I actually think Tony's point about the entrepreneurship of the Chinese people. I said in my speech the story of the Chinese migrants to the goldfields in Victoria and elsewhere in the 19th century. I mean, they developed the first retail emporiums and took them back to China, you know, those Chinese Australians. And you see that today.
Chinese shopkeepers were a staple of 19th century Australia, weren't they? Yeah.
In fact, my ancestors who had the general stores and the wandering Jew paddle steamer in rural New South Wales sold their shop to a Chinese family who lived downstairs from me in Randwick. So there you go.
Trooper Yin Gan was one of the first Anzacs ashore at Gallipoli.
Yeah.
Senator Thomas Backup sat in the Federation Parliaments.
Yes.
But this has been a very repressive regime now for, well, since 1949 when it comes to power in Beijing, but in parts of China before that. I mean, it goes back 70, 80 years, the Chinese Communist Party regime. It's not going to be easy. You wouldn't expect it to fall over, would you? Or you might.
I think there's members of the ruling party and government now that have been a bit surprised by the last 5 years by the aggression. I mean, China's never been an expansionist power, but there'd be people, I think, at senior levels, you know, who would think, you know, the current leader is very different than Hu Jintao or Jiang Zemin. It's very different to who Tony Abbott was dealing with as Prime Minister and John Howard was and Bob Hawke was, you know. So I think that is a surprise and that could put a lot of pressure on them.
What about member sending a question about free trade agreement, which was a product, as you know, of the Abbott government and the Chinese government. But look what they've done to our beef and barley. I mean, was it worth it, they'd ask.
Look, because we have traditionally been a very open economy, free trade deals, even with countries with rather different wage rates and standards, have tended to be beneficial for us. And if you look at the last 5 years of our trade with China, China's exports to us have gone up by 8%, but our exports to China have gone up by 15%. So I would say that the free trade deal that my government finalised has been more beneficial to us than it has been to China. As I said, I want us to sell as much as we possibly can to China. I want us to be much more careful about what we buy from China. What I particularly want us to be much more careful about is allowing ourselves to become too dependent on Chinese components in our supply chain. I think that's the big problem the West has got at the moment. China has permeated so much of the Western supply chain that we have a very unhealthy dependence upon a country that sees trade as geopolitics by other means.
Jim, free trade agreement, worth it?
I always think free trade agreements are necessary but not sufficient. You know, in a few areas where there's, you know, agricultural barriers and so on, they can be very helpful. But at the end of the day, there's behind the border issues, there's cultural and regulatory issues that matter more. And even when you look at free trade agreements, whether they be with China or the US or other countries, they're quite a good marketing tool. They're a good way to feel good about the relationship. But at the end of the day, the exporters have got many, many things on their plate. And now, even with Indonesia, where we've had tensions over bombings and terrorism and so on, we've still seen, you know, the numbers of companies going to Indonesia still growing. So I think they help, but they're not everything. And most of the time, it's good to have the government badge on the ground. You know, when you're an exporter in Shandong or in Wuhan or out in the West, having the ambassador or the Austrade office or the trade commissioner there helping you in a country run by the government is really important, and that matters for that matter in Indonesia or the Middle East as well, where you have a lot of government involvement.
Someone sent in a question about, we're getting towards the end now, but how do we moderate people in the business world who want to placate China? I mean, is that necessary, or do you expect some people in business to talk their book? Is there a problem with Twiggy Forrest talking his book?
Rowan Kallick wrote a very good piece about this. I mean, at the end of the day...
Rowan Kallick writes in The Australian?
Yes, yes. He's now... he was, of course, the Beijing correspondent for The Australian and The Fin Review. He's now, I think, in Queensland at one of the universities. So he's followed this for a long time. And basically, having 8,000 or so Australian small businesses in China, doing things in China is great. You know, you get the people-to-people relationships, you get to understand people better and so on. But business people have got to be very, very careful not to be put in a position where they're running the party line for China here. Because ultimately, that's not helpful to the people of China. It's not helpful for their business partners. And it's not in Australia's national interest. So
okay, why is it not helpful for their business partners?
They do not want... they don't particularly want tensions between Australia and China. They want things to progress. And... now, James Packer or Twiggy Forrest coming up and criticising the Australian government, causing sparks to fly in Beijing, is not what they want. They want stability and they want people flying under the radar. So you can understand people talking their book, but they actually prefer things nice and quiet, nice and stable, rather than sparks flying all the time.
So finally, Tony, you were a successful Prime Minister. You had a good relationship with... the Australian government had a good relationship with China. Looking back on it now, what's your recollection of those... I mean, you were a senior minister before that, but what's your recollection of those couple of years you were Prime Minister in the China relationship? And is there anything we can do better? Or did you learn any lessons or anything we can do better?
Look, I think two things have changed, if you like. I think China has changed. I think our perceptions of China have changed. And I certainly got the impression from Xi Jinping in 2013 and 2014 that this was a man we could do business with, not a man who was necessarily our soulmate or even particularly like-minded with us, but nevertheless someone we could do business with. And if you go back and read the speeches that he gave in Australia back in late 2014, I think they were remarkable. I think they were genial. They certainly seemed decent. But so much that's happened since then in China, obviously at the behest or at the instigation of the government, hasn't been genial or decent at all. I mean, the treatment of the Uyghurs, outrageous, an abomination. The treatment of Hong Kong, wrong, dead wrong. The threats to Taiwan, unconscionable. Whatever you might think about, you know, China's long-term claim over Taiwan, the tensions on the borders, I think invariably China is responsible. And what we are seeing now is a hegemonic power, clearly a hegemonic power. Tim made the point that China's never been expansionist. I think that was the term he used. Yes and no. But in the old days, China dominated the only world it knew completely. And you were either an enemy or a vassal. There was no real concept of an independent sovereign state with which China dealt with on equal terms. None. And I think what we're seeing is the compounding of traditional Chinese exceptionalism with a large dollop of rather vicious Marxism-Leninism.
Well, that's an interesting thought on which to conclude from your own personal recollection. So many thanks to number 28, Tony Abbott, and many thanks to the airport economist, Tim Harcourt.
Thank you.
Good on you, Jared.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.